Do you crave really focused professional instruction in Italian wine, but find yourself so busy that a flexible schedule for coursework would be a must? Napa Valley Wine Academy, America's premier wine school, has an excellent solution for you. The online Italian wine professional course, taught over 8 weeks at your own pace. Developed by Italian Wine Central and endorsed by both the Italian Trade Commission and Slow Wine, the Italian Wine Professional sets a high standard for Italian wine education. This online program provides diverse and extensive study materials, webinars with industry experts, quizzes, an online exam, and even Italian pronunciation practice. Go to NapaValleyWineAcademy.com, that's NapaValleyWineAcademy.com, and click on Courses and Online Learning to sign up for the Italian Wine Professional online course. Or call 855-513-9738, that's 855-513-9738, to register over the phone. Use the discount code LEVI, N-V-W-A, that's L-E-V-I, N-V-W-A, to receive 10% off of the course tuition. Would you like to get into the vast world of Italian wine? The Italian Wine Professional course is the perfect way to get serious about Italian vino on a schedule that's up to you. I'll Drink to That, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levi Dalton.
I'm Erin Scala.
And here's our show today.
I'm Paul Osborne, Beverage Director of Parkside Projects Restaurant Group in Austin, Texas, and I love 750.
Jared Sedoyan, Bar Manager at the Hawthorne in Boston.
I'm Sean Paul, General Manager and Wine Buyer from Corkbuzz, Charlotte, North Carolina.
Massimo Seredimini, Beverage Director at Eataly in Chicago.
Take it from these buyers. 750 has become the modern resource for restaurants, retailers, and bars all across the country. 750 gives them access to detailed wholesale pricing, a calendar of upcoming trade tastings, and seamless connections to their sales reps. Sign up today for free at 750.com. That's 750 spelled out, .com. Giacomo Conterno of the Aldo Conterno Winery in Monforte on the show today. Hello, sir. How are you?
It's a pleasure to be here.
Very nice to have you here. So you're Giacomo Conterno, but you're at the Aldo Conterno Winery, which I, for some people will take some...
No. For more than some people, because Conterno in Monforte is like it's a surname like Schmidt, so there are a lot of people that are the name is Conterno, and the original family, my family, and the Giacomo Conterno winery family was the one that started. Well, the oldest document of our family is a bill dated 1770. It's a bill of Barolo. But, of course, as I told you, there are many other families named Conterno. The only relationship in terms of blood is between the Podera do Conterno, my family, and Giacomo Conterno. And all the other Conternos are very good producers, but we don't have relationship in terms of blood and family. And so when my father and my uncle Giovanni, they used to work together under the Giacomo Conterno winery. For us, you know, things were very different because after World War II, there were only three wineries in Monforte. So there was less confusion. There was Zabaldano, my family, and another family called Odero, that I think had also a relationship with the other famous Odero in Santa Maria.
And but Zabaldano was the famous for Barolo Chinato, the pharmacy family.
Zabaldano was absolutely one of the most famous producer of Barolo Chinato. And so, you know, in that period, there were many wine growers, but less wineries compared to today. And of course, then little by little, thanks to the fact that many people discovered the Barolo, many wine growers that maybe they use also to produce wine, but they didn't export, they started to be more well known. And we were lucky because my grandfather was born in Argentina, so there was a possibility for us already in that period to export The only problem is that sometimes, you know, we were a little bit afraid because on the port of Genova was the place in which we ship the wines. And we were always a little bit afraid because in that period takes a lot of time for the trip. And sometimes instead of the wine in the barrel, there was just the water. Maybe some sailors were going to drink it. And so you were always afraid until they received the papers that they say, no, there was wine inside, okay. But no, it's, to me, it's fantastic still today to do this job, because I always think that when you have the possibility to born in one place, live in this place, and maybe die in the same place, is an opportunity that few people have.
Giacomo Quinterno, the person, was born in Argentina.
Yes. Then, when he was very young, I think 4 or 5 years old, his mother passed away, unfortunately. And so my great-grandfather said, I'm alone with all this my family. And
back in Italy.
Back in Italy, and why not? I'm here maybe for that reason. And but there is still a big Piedmontese community in Argentina, so it's nice to know that there are some roots also there.
So you were able to export Barolo to Argentina through family connections?
In that period, yes.
In the 19th century.
Yes, and the end of the 19th century, yes. Then, of course, when my father, because, of course, they still have some brothers there, but then when my great-grandfather came back home, of course, there was more focus here. You never know what happened in life. Maybe my grandfather, when he was very young, talked that his destiny was in Argentina. Then there was this said for her mother, and we are here. If maybe this didn't happen today, we cannot speak here. Maybe we could be in Tucumán or in other places.
So Giacomo, your namesake, was also your grandfather.
Yes.
And he had two sons, Giovanni and Aldo.
That's it, yes. Also other two sisters, but they were not involved in the winery. And so my uncle Giovanni and my father, Aldo, they worked together for many years.
So your dad actually went to America for a while.
Yes, because when he was in the beginning of the 50s, he has this uncle, quite old and quite rich. But if I'm not wrong, he didn't have family. So he asked my father to go in the United States, because his idea was to run a winery in Sonoma. That in that period, you know, was absolutely, you know, intriguing. And when my father received the letter saying, Aldo, would you like to come in the United States? And he said, America, for a young boy of the 50s, when in Montfort we have two cars for one village, in America we have two cars for one family. So I think my father arrived in America before his letter, because he was absolutely happy and he came in the United States. But then someone suggested him to have the green card. That was an issue also in that period. They suggested him to join the army. And he said, okay, why not? I'm going also to learn more English. I'm going to be more part of this, of the U.S. And I was very proud. The timing, in my opinion, was not perfect, because there was also the Korea war. But so he spent 1 year in Seoul. And then when he came back, the uncle was very old and the project ended. But of course, he was in America and he spends other 3-4 years. I still have, about 2 weeks ago, I just received the visit of the son of his boss. It was fantastic. He showed me about the salary for 1 week, if I'm not wrong, was $170 per week. In that period, I think, was because my father was used to work for a company that sells food and other things. So it was like an agent, you know. And I see this paper and I see the hours written by my father. I recognize his signature. You know, it was something that hit me a little bit in terms of emotion. You know, it was fantastic. But then, of course, after 3, 4, 5 years, most of the time he lived in Berkeley, because he had another uncle at the restaurant 1.5 kilometers from the university. And so I think he enjoyed the life during that period. And then he came back and restart what was always in his mind, because his idea was not to stay in America, but to have this incredible experience. You know, to go in U.S. for a Piedmontese guy in the 50s was to just see what will happen in Italy after 40 years. It's like a machine for the future. And I think was unique for him. And the other big advantage, when he came back in Italy, he has the possibility to understand and speak English. That in that period was really rare.
And I think ahead of the game, because he probably spoke some Korean too. So for the export market.
So for now, when we talk with the South Korea, that is a country that is absolutely increasing, I like to say also that.
But that uncle in California had died as well.
Yes. And so the project ended. But the... Of course, for as I told you, for my father was an incredible experience. He never came back in U.S., never, because I think the idea he had in that period was so, you know, deep in his heart. And he said, that's that kind of America. And my father was always a great supporter of America. When I remember there was maybe some TV show that they say something against, you know, some specific political. My father said, no, America is America. And they always told us as a guy, you have to love this country because I understand the things there that they completely changed my life. So I was really a true believer of US. And I think that this is one of the reasons why he always asked this idea to also with us. He said, visit the United States, try to understand a lot about these people, because I met this culture when I was very young and it changed my life. And now, by chance, it was not absolutely wrong, because the United States is one of the biggest markets for Barolo. So maybe he already knew something in that period.
But what was your dad like? I mean, when you recall him?
My father was a typical Piedmontese. He liked to enjoy life, friends. And it was a typical father of a generation that was not used, you know, to involve the kids like we are seeing now. To me, it was more like a mentor.
So your dad was born in 1931.
Yes.
And when did he get married about?
1963.
Oh, so right in that period of time where he split with his brother and started his own life, like that area.
Yes, they started to talk about the split in beginning of the 60s, but Podera do Conterno was started in 1969. But there are a lot of bottles of Aldo Conterno 1931. Of the 50s, the 40s, and many people asked me, but if they split it in 1969, how this could... But when they split it, they also split the wine they had in the cellar. In that period, it was very common to have very old vintages of Barolo in damagens, you know, this 54 liters big bottle. And so all those vintages that were there. So when they split, my uncle took the right to continue as Giacomo Conterno, and my father took the right to bottle all the old vintages as Podera do Conterno that they were split during, they were divided when they decided to have to separate destiny, you know.
So a 55 Giacomo Conterno and a 55 Aldo Conterno are essentially the same wine.
Not the same wine, because they used to buy also grapes from different crew. They used to rent. So it could be, of course, the same vintage, but maybe coming in that period, you have to consider that there was not the same crew concept we have now. So in that period, it was much more common to blend different positions. So it could happen that maybe some damagens were part of a crew and other damagens were part of another crew. So we have the same vintage, but two different terroirs.
But they would have both been labeled the same. They would have said Barolo, not with... You know.
Yeah.
So it would be, you would have to know from the taste or where it was in the cellar.
Yeah.
Do you think your dad preferred certain crews at that time?
Well, my father, as I told you, was influenced by my grandfather. And my grandfather had two places in his, one was Serra Lunga and the other was Busia. And so when the two brothers split, it was easy for them to decide where to go. My father was really in love with Romy Rasco since the beginning. I remember we rented Romy Rasco for many years, and finally, being a very good friend of the banks, we had the chance to buy this land
in 1980, right?
Yes, and I remember his love for Romy Rasco was incredible, and in fact we produce a wine called Gran Busia that is a Reserva, and when he had the possibility to do the blend, because in the beginning it was just a blend of or Cicala or Colonnello, but when we bought the Romy Rasco, his idea was I will have 70% Romy Rasco, 15 Cicala, 15 Colonnello, because Romy Rasco must be the backbone of the. So I remember, and I can understand that we have still a map dated 1875 that shows that the Romy Rasco was considered one of the best crew of the region there. And I'm very proud to own this map, but much more happy to own the hill, honestly speaking.
So today that's part of Busia.
Yes.
And he basically put his winery across the street from Romy Rasco.
Yes, yes, yes. And there is still the Romy Rasco house where I live. That is the house that gave the name to the hill. And this house built more than 200 years ago.
So the first Gran Busia was in the 70, 74? Or?
Well, 70.
Okay.
But very few bottles. We can consider 71 as the start. But there are also some 70.
And that is today a blend of Romy Rasco, Cicala, and Colonnello?
Always 70% Romy Rasco, 15% Cicala, and 15% Colonnello. But you have to consider that in the end of the 90s, me and my two brothers, we decided to, let's say, change a little bit our approach. It's very difficult today to drink a bad wine. There are good wines everywhere, and the 90s were the golden age for wine everywhere. If we go back 30 or 40 years, 30% of the wineries disappears. There is a huge number of wineries that started to bottle before. Maybe they, of course, they were wine growers, but they prefer more to sell grapes or to sell to some domestic market. But the 90s were the moment in which there was a big wake up in terms of investors, that they were more seriously interested in developing projects with wine, in terms also of customers, wine lovers. And I think, as happened with all the other things in life, technology played a huge role, because internet started in that. And so for people, it was very easy to share, to exchange. And the wine consultant started in the 90s. Think before, for a wine grower, the only possibility was to hire a full-time wine consultant. Too expensive. Today I can ask for some advice, but the wine consultant could take care of 60, 70, even more wineries. So the 90s shaped completely
this
our
area.
Present. Yes.
Yeah.
I think they shaped every area.
But in terms of that shift from small grower to small domain, that really happened here in a big way.
Yes, yes, yes. No, I think that many wine growers, they understood that they had a possibility. The market changed. There was much more, attention. So many, many wine growers decided or to hire a winemaker or to do by themselves. And so in the 90s, it was clear for us that it was an incredible moment also for export. We had the Italian lira, and as a currency, was stronger than any army. We could attack any country. It was unbelievable. Today, with euro, is a little bit more complicated. But I remember the export was crazy. You just say, I have produced a new wine. Okay, the importer said, send me 6,000, 7,000 bottles. So it was a thing that I never seen in my life before, and also now is different. And so many wineries, many good wines, And we understood that quality was not enough. So was the time more and more for identity. And identity means that people like me, people hate me, but I hope everybody recognizes me. This is a little bit the idea of the identity. So we cannot please everybody. And we don't have to please everybody. I think we must be a little bit selfish, because you have to be free to decide what to do. But identity is the only way for you to tell your story, to deliver your message. So we used to produce in the end of the 90s, we used to produce 200,000 bottles with 25 hectares. And we were in front of a big cross, because as I told you, the economy was incredible. Remember, we had the dot-com in that period, so there was a lot of cash. People were investing a lot in wine. And America exploded in terms of a market, and we started to ship a lot of Barolo. But we noticed that we had 200,000 bottles, our winery, our cellar is 5,000 square meters, so we have room for maybe 400,000 or 500,000 bottles. And many wineries in that period, they decided to grow. So if we go back 20 years, many wineries are tiny compared to today. Well, we decided to do the contrary. Why? Because we noticed that just to produce a correct wine, or what we could say a safe wine, that everybody could agree that is nice, but maybe they don't feel the real soul, was not good for us. And the idea, when we were in front of this cross, we said maybe we could buy new land because we had a lot of space. 5,000 square meters is a big space. Many people told us in that period, you are three brothers. It's time to expand, everybody. And more they told us to do that, the more we were convinced to do the contrary. And so we said, let's do the contrary. Few bottles, but be 100% in charge. I'm not against wine consultant. They are doing a great job. But we have a family that produce wine since many generations. And for us, it was very important to put our hands and to be 100% responsible. In a good or in a bad way, yeah, because you never know. But in any case, it's my wine. And it's my identity. It's my story.
So basically, you stopped buying in grapes.
No. The 90s, when we arrived, the first vintage that my two brothers that are older than me did was 1989. And then already in that period, when my brothers arrived, we decided to focus. We used to rent also some lands, but we decided to focus very much on our 25 hectares. And then, as I told you, there was this golden age of the 90s. And in the end of the 90s, we said, we could maybe continue with 200,000. We could buy more land. We could rent more land. The prices were not like today, so it was more easy for a winery to expand a little bit. Their lands. But then the idea, as I told you, was opposite. Just few bottles and 100% control.
So your dad had a preference for Mikkei? He liked it?
Yes. Mikkei was always kind of Nebbiolo that was in his heart. He said that he likes very much the aromatic side of the Mikkei, and I totally agree with you. So, this idea of my father.
So what is the soil makeup of Romoresco, Cicala, Colonnolo?
Monforte, Castiglione, but in particular Bussia, because Bussia is the last district of Monforte on the border between Barolo and Castiglione Falletto. And Bussia is really a blend. I think that one of the reasons why my grandfather and then my father were really touched by this region is that you have a really a mix of the different terroirs. In fact, we have three hills in Bussia. The three highest hills are Colonnello, Cicala, and Romoresco. And these three hills, they represent a little bit the Barolo region. For example, Colonnello has a lot of sand, magnesium, manganese, so more close to the Barolo-Lamora area. Cicala is the typical Bussia area with more this little bit of clay, iron. It's very steep at the hill, and it represents very much this a bit more male side of the Barolo. And Romoresco is very close to the Cicala as the type of soil, but with a little bit of this magnesium, more typical from the Colonnello, that offers this spicy taste in the Romoresco. That is the reason why we like to have 70% in our Riserva Gran Bussia. And the idea of the Gran Bussia is to honor the old-fashioned way of blending the different crew. So in Grand Bussia, we have Cicala 15%, Colonnello 15%, Rumirasco 70%. But just to give you an idea of what we have changed. Before the 2001, the Grand Bussia, we blended the three crew after the first fermentation. And then we did 4 or 5 weeks of skin contact. And we used to produce 10, 11,000 bottles. Starting from the 2001, we decided to have one barrel dedicated only for the Grand Bussia. We harvest the same day, the three crew. So we co-ferment. No temperature controlled fermentation, a skin contact of 2, sometimes 2.5 months. So it's a completely different kind of approach. But why? Because we want to use this freedom to be more and more close to the concept of the Riserva. And I think the combination of these three hills, that they represent a little bit the mix of the different terroirs in the Barolo area, helps a lot to us to reach this goal. And so the only sad part is that as we have to harvest all in one day, instead of 10, 11,000 bottles, we are around 3,600. So this was a price that we have to pay. But as I told you, when we could be more focused, we are happy to pay this price.
So when you did the blending of the different parcels after the ferment, and then when you did co-ferment, when you started that, of the same parcels, in the mouth and the nose, what did you see?
I think the advantage to co-ferment is also that, and decide to have more than 2 months of skin contact, forced us to select the best berries, to be even more strict. And in that case, you can really also focus on in each hill of the plots that you think in that vintage could better perform together with the other two hills. So before, of course, was absolutely nice too, but maybe it was more an engineer blend. The concept of Riserva now starts from the first day of the harvest. Since the beginning, one day you decide to harvest part of the Romirasco, part of the Chica, and then you co-ferment. So it's a real fusion, more than a blend after the first fermentation. Then before, we fermented and still, and then the second fermentation. No, now one barrel dedicated to that, first and second fermentation.
But in the 80s, though, Grand Bussia would have, and some of the other Barolo would have been fermented in steel.
Yes.
But no longer for the Grand Bussia.
No. 2001, we decided to offer more layers to enter another dimension, maybe more old-fashioned dimension, respect to the 90s. And this was the idea, and we are happy to continue. But for the other crew, they do the first fermentation in steel. They do 4 or 5 weeks of skin contact, and then the second fermentation in a big barrel. The Grand Bussia, since the beginning, in a big barrel, no temperature control. So we take also sometimes a risk, because it's 8 years, the total work of the Grand Bussia. It could happen that after 6 years, we called the importer and said, I told you about the Grand Bussia, but no, there's no Grand Bussia. But people pay for that. My Grand Bussia is not cheap. This is the reason why, for example, in 2002 and 2003, that for us were very complicated vintages. In both vintages, we tried to produce the Barolo. We aged the Barolo for more than 3 years. When it was time to bottle, we didn't bottle. But this is part of the game. Honestly speaking, Piedmont is in a very, very good position now. From 2004 to 2015, we were very lucky. We have different styles. Some people are saying that maybe 14 is a little bit more challenging. I agree, but if the people did the right selection in 14, trust me, we will see big surprises. Few bottles, but big surprises. So I'm not the one so pessimist about 14. But we have different styles. Let's say 5, 6, 8, 10, 13, 14, we could consider a little bit more classic vintages. Cooler summers, late harvest, this incredible brightness of the acidity, very big tannin structure. Then we have like 7, 9, 11, 15, more ripe. So this means more generous, maybe more easy also for people that they want to approach to a Barolo a little bit younger. Some vintages like 10 or six, you have to wait 10, 15 years, even more, to really, really have the balance. And these are incredible vintages that I'm sure they will always tell about the greatness of Barolo, but you cannot drink young. There are vintages like 11 that you can approach younger, and in my opinion, it's a fantastic opportunity. They could live 10, 15 years with no problem, but you can start just to drink down 2-3 years from now, and you will be more than pleased. And 12, what we are having now is something in between. Is an expression of a ripe vintage, but together with a very interesting tannin structure. And honestly speaking, I like vintages like 12 because they give me more space. And are always vintages like that, that in my opinion, build the reputation of a winery and are much more intriguing. So I'm having a lot of fun now with the 12.
Do you see a pattern in what vintages end up being Grambusia? Because you don't make it every year.
No. But the Grambusia now, every year we try. The thing is that after 8 years, we decide or not to bottle. But we must do now every year. And this gives us much more sense. Because if I have to co-ferment and I have that barrel only for Grambusia, I must try every year. And then if things are so bad, we will not bottle. And we declassify as... We cannot put in the crew, we cannot do nothing with the classifier as a table wine, and because if it is wrong, it's wrong. So it's not that we could do something in between.
Is that true? Yeah.
No, of course.
You keep for the family or you?
For the family, sometimes those wines we prefer, when you're disappointed with Grambusia, is a big pain in your heart. You prefer to...
Get it out of the house.
Yes. But in any case, honestly speaking, we are talking about bottles that they cost. We are talking about bottles that in which we hope people will invest. So the minimum, I'm not here to tell you, I'm going to sacrifice. No, it's part of the game. We are lucky that there are people that invest, and we have always to prove them that they do a right investment. And this doesn't mean that they have 100% to like the wine, but they have 100% to understand that I put all my effort to produce that. So every vintage we try, and some vintages then during the journey we understand that was not the case, and we don't bottle. Honestly speaking, we also did in 14, because in my opinion, very, very few, but we are very happy about the 14.
Oh, so you're going to make a Grambusia in 14?
Yes.
Because it's a difficult year.
It's a difficult year, but as I told you before, our more challenging vintages in which we have a... incredible example for many producers that in challenging vintages, then they produce a masterpiece.
So do you see a pattern, though, in which years have worked out or not in terms of weather?
Maybe more classic vintages, like was the 10, 8, and 14, because honestly speaking, 14 was the weather that was very common 40 years ago, rain and not so hot. So I think that the Riserva has more chance in classic vintages. For example, we didn't produce the 11. We tried, but during the journey, we said, okay, maybe it's better not to produce the Riserva. But we are so pleased about the Romerasco, Cicale, and Colonnello 11.
So is it the case that the Colonnello, Romerasco, and Cicale are temperature-controlled ferments?
Yes.
Grambusia is not, though.
No.
And so in a warmer year, you're getting higher sugars.
Yeah, higher sugars, maybe you could have more difficulties also in the cellar because the temperature of 11 was one of the warmest autumn we had. So there are many things that could change a little bit the situation and maybe push us to go to not produce the Grambusia. But in any case, we did the harvest. Now the barrel is... somewhere, we will not produce the 11, but in any case, now every year we have to do that because we have to harvest all as to start the Riserva in the vineyards.
Do the parcels for Grambusia tend to be the same within those vineyards?
Well, it's 70% of Romerasco, 15 Cicale, but you have to consider, for example, Romerasco is more than 3 hectares, Cicale is more than 3 hectares. So now, with the production we do, Cicale we produce 5,000-6,000 bottles, Romerasco 5,000-6,000 bottles, and with more than 3 hectares, we have a potential of 17,000-18,000 bottles, just to give you the idea. But, and so we have a lot of room to decide also the plot for the Grambusia, because in total, Grambusia is around 3,000 bottles now. So usually the Grambusia comes from the top of Romerasco, the top of Colonnello, the top of Cicala, because we think that it's the steepest part of the hill with more wind, so more healthy also in terms of the skin, because when you decide to do a long maceration, you trust your skin. Because if you have a skin so-so, you do a short maceration.
So is it true that in the windier parcels, you're getting thicker skins?
The humidity changed completely, and so the skin react with the humidity. And just after a storm is the part that get is drying before. Okay, so it's very important, the wind. You what you said is, in my opinion, absolutely right.
There's less chance that you're going to have a little bit of rot on the skin, and it might be
we tend always to have late harvest. Mm-hmm. This is one of the reasons why also we lose a lot of grapes.
So for Grand Boussier, you either bottle it or you don't bottle it. For the three component crews, I feel like sometimes some of them are bottled, but not all three, and sometimes all three. Or...
I give you an idea with a vintage. 2004, I consider fantastic. And it's fantastic because they never close down the wines. I don't know if you agree with me, but always when you taste it, there are some vintages like 6, like 10 now. You taste the wine and 04 is always there. So generous, so floral. And in 04, unfortunately, the hail and hailstorm destroyed the Cicala production. So also, we didn't produce the Grand Boussier. Many people told us, but you didn't produce 2002 Grand Boussier, no 2003. Why no 2004? Because I said, the people that follow the Grand Boussier, they know that Grand Boussier is the fusion of the three crew. So if now I miss the Cicala, and I say, ah, okay, but in any case, I will produce Grand Boussier, I will betray the concept of Grand Boussier. So people, they know that when it comes, we have a good vintage and the three crew there. The other example is 2007, for example, we didn't produce the Grand Boussier since the beginning, like the four, because the Romirasco was hurted by the hail. So in that case, even the first day could not start, because if I miss one crew, I cannot do the co-fermentation of the three. So this is why sometimes you don't see my, because unfortunately the hail, with the global warming, the hailstorms now are very aggressive. In 11 was different. We tried to produce the Grand Boussier, but then we said no.
So did the grapes look different in the different crews? Like when you go
well,
through?
Well, mainly our Mickey and our muscle selection. So the mix. Honestly speaking, there's not a huge difference, but maybe the soil could play a role in the consistency sometimes of the skin because the soils react in a different way with the climate. So there could be. But of course, the Mickey is Mickey, and there is not this huge difference among. And then the three hills are 50 meters far, Romirasco, Cicala, and this is the other amazing part. Just a few meters, they completely change the situation. I think the grape outside look, as I told you, quite the same, but maybe inside, because of the reaction of the soil, things they could be very different. In fact, usually the Colonnello is much more floral, more quick fruit, more the expression of the sandy soil. Cicala is a very steep hill, which the soil is more poor than Colonnello. So the roots, they really have to dig to find water. So they explore much more layers underground. And this means much more microelement in contact with the roots. And the fact that Cicala is a little bit more, let's say, male, earthy, leather, dark fruits, a touch of balsamic. And then there is the Romirasco that is mainly Cicala soil with this slightly magnesium that I think is the secret of this incredible spice and dense fruit. And so there's, of course, an interaction with the soil, but more not from the shape of the berries, but inside, yes.
So I've always been curious, with the three crews and then Grand Boussier, are the length of mallow different?
Having the Grand Boussier for a longer time in contact with the skin also helps the mallow more. So it could happen that the Grand Boussier starts the mallow before the other, because skin means richness, the seeds and all together. So I think sometimes the Grand Boussier has more opportunity to end the mallow before, but it's impossible really to predict. Also because we don't add the bacteria, everything is natural. We use indigenous yeast, indigenous bacteria. So you wait, knowing that if it is a good vintage, things they will come. Spring is incredible because sometimes when you don't have the mallow in autumn, you know, we are under, we are really feeling the nature. And you know why in spring usually the models start? Because in spring, the vegetation moves. So bacteria are part of this world. And as many times when the mallow doesn't start in the end of December or springtime, puff, again. Of course, you must have space. You don't have to be, as I told you before, too many wineries, when the new vintage comes, they have to bottle the old vintages. So in terms of opportunities, they lose the possibility really to listen to their wine. There is more pressed by logistic. One of the reasons why we have 5,000 square meters for 70,000 bottles, that, as I told you, for many people is a crazy decision, is really to have this kind of possibilities, the time to decide and not the logistic.
It seems to me when I taste that the wines from 2001 and later seem a little more topped up than the 80s, and maybe it's my imagination. But
yes, because of course we know that oxygen could be a disaster. So, as I told you before, the wines need oxygen, but in the right proportion, like water for a flower. But we have to be very careful, because before we didn't know all the data that today are clear. So to fill up is absolutely important. You always have to your barrel full. Now everybody's much more careful.
So my big question for you, this is my riddle. Is you have one barrel of Grand-Bussy, and how do you top it up?
Because we have one barrel, but we always have a part, a barrel of, let's say, 2-3 hectoliters, a part in which we take the juice to top the big one.
Okay. Always. I feel like I just learned a secret.
No. This always. Because otherwise, you are right, could be a problem. No. We produce the Grand-Bussy, and then 200 or 300 liters are a part just to top. Otherwise, it could be a problem.
And that's in Damigiano, or?
We tend to use Damigians, yes. 3 or 4 Damigianos, sometimes 5, yes. Because the wine is there, and it can help us to fill up.
And then it's Slavonian oak boat, eh?
Slavonian oak, yes. We work with the barrel cooper called Garbellotto.
Some of the older cooperage, do you go in and kind of take the layer out?
You mean if we scrape?
Yeah, scrape the inside.
The first job that I did when I was 5 years old was to scrape barrels, because I was slim. If I ask now my son to do this, I think the police will come. Before, my wife will kill me, but I think the police will come and take me in a jail for, I don't know, 30 years. But it was very common in that period. A lot of people did that. I was 5 years old, and we have to enter in this little door, and I scrape. It takes 1.5 hour. And this was one of the secrets why I'm in, with my two brothers was easy to, because the two people outside the barrel are my two brothers. You know, I'm the youngest, so I have to work. And no, but it was funny, really. I was 5, my brothers were just a little older than me. But the first thing we do, my father said, we have to scrape the barrel because the tartrates, they could close the pore. And so if you scrape a little bit, you get free the pore again, but you have not to be so aggressive, otherwise you go on the green side of the barrel. And this could be an issue in terms of, again, having a green also influence on the wine.
So for the different Barolo, do you use press wine or is it all free-run juice?
Honestly speaking, for the cru, no. We prefer, and maybe for the base Barolo, the press part we put there.
So free run for the cruise,
yeah,
and Grand-Bussy too.
Of course, yeah.
Because it has a density to them, but I think that's from the grape variety and the yields.
The yields, I think, is the biggest thing. As I told you, with the Romierasco, with Cicala, we are more than 3 hectares, and we are always around 4,000, 5,000, 6,000, it depends. So we try to be very careful on the yield. But it's more also selecting the vines that we think they could perform in that vintage. So this kind of freedom for us is absolutely important.
So when you propagate vine material, do you do it just within each vineyard, or do you move to different vineyards?
We try to stay inside the cru, because we like to think that we are not losing the authentic stamp. So we prefer to do that. Stay inside the cru and stay with the muscle. So we take the year before, and then we will re- use, yes.
And in terms of the Cruz and then Grand Bucia, as they age, do you see a different curve for them? I mean, obviously, vintages are different.
The Grand Bucia is always the one that asks more time. But usually, the one that is more open, because, as I told you, the soil is with this more sand, magnesium, and manganese, is the Colonello. And then Cicala, then Romirasco, and then Grand Bucia. And some vintages could be the opposite. You know that many times in the very warm vintages, sometimes the one that is has you know, a different kind of exposure that usually in classic is not outstanding, in the very warm one is the one that performed better. So, but let's say in a usual vintage, I will start to open the Colonello, then after some years Cicala, Romirasco, and the last will be the Grand Bucia.
So your crews are all part of the larger crew of Bucia.
Yes.
How should I understand Bucia as a place and then your crews within it? I mean, the differences.
We have Bucia Soprana, where all are my crews. That means up Bucia.
Because there's a Bucia Sotana.
A Bucia Sotana.
And right. That's different.
Yes. There are two different. I am very lucky because my crew, Romirasco, Cicala, and Colonello, are the highest hill of the classic Bucia Soprana. Many people, they ask me and they are afraid, they say, oh, but why Bucia is so big? To me, I don't feel this kind of pressure. I mean, it's like to go in Bordeaux and say, why there's a Margaux of 30 euros and why there's Chateau Margaux? Different reasons, different ways. So the Bucia is a large MGA, but I'm proud to be in Bucia. There are bottles of the Barolo Bucia end of the 19th century. The Vigna Colonello was, the former owner was a colonel of the Napoleon army, the legend said. So Bucia is big because Bucia offers plenty of possibilities. And I understand that for many journalists, they say, ah, okay, but you know, it's so big, there's no possibility to understand. I mean, but I don't feel so much this pressure on. I don't think that is a map that makes a wine. I think that in Bucia, we were very lucky. Already in the end of the 19th century, there were bottles of Bucia that were sold in California. And so, by the Arnulfo family. So I think that this is a big privilege. In Bucia, there are many nice hills, and Bucia is simply a largest extension with more options, and so there are many producers that they could spread the message of Bucia, and to me, is an advantage, not a disadvantage.
So another famous vineyard in Monforte is Ginestra.
Yes.
And how would you compare that to Bucia? If I were trying to understand Monforte as a bigger region.
Ginestra is, in my opinion, a crew with power. It's more close to an idea of Serralunga, in my opinion. In Bucia, you have more this mix, this combination between a very interesting tanning structure, but also this hint of floral, this hint of crisp. So in Bucia, I love to focus on the fruit. But when you say Ginestra, to me, is heaven too. So, but I think it's a little bit more male versus the feminine. Bucia, to me, is a little bit more feminine versus the Ginestra. So it depends very much also on the style of the crew that you like. But
so you mentioned before at the beginning of this interview the Zabaldano family.
Yes.
And they had vines in Bucia.
Yes.
And where were those vines? Because that family no longer exists.
Yeah, no. The vines were on the bottom of Cru de Cicala and Colonello. But, you know, in that period, many owners. So maybe you could have a piece here, a piece there. But yes, there was just close to my crew, yes.
So Cicala and Colonello.
On the bottom, yes.
Do you own those vines now, the Zabaldano vines?
No. Just a little part. Just a little part. Not 100% owned by us.
And Zabaldano was famous for kind of co-creating Barolo Chinato.
Yes.
And Monforte Barolo Chinato,
yes,
in particular.
Yes, very famous for that, yes.
And your dad made a Barolo Chinato produced at the winery that he used to give to people as gifts.
Yes.
Was there any connection there? Or?
No, of course, I'm sure, but this is my idea, that my father was inspired in part also like people like Zabaldano. So I was keen on doing a Barolo Chinato that already my grandfather did. But of course, when you have the possibility to have Zabaldano in the same village, I'm sure it will do its best to taste. Well, to know the recipe, I don't think so, because still my father was very jealous. We have stopped to produce the Barolo Chinato because the recipe was in his head. He never decided to write because he said, I think it's something in my... And we stopped to produce Barolo Chinato because we want to honor what he did and not to make a stupid copy now that I'm sure will be not the same. And so for him... To have the chance to speak with people like Zabaldano, I think was the best desire, because when you like to produce something like a Barolo Chinato and you have a master like Zabaldano, I think that could be absolutely a nice possibility to exchange some information. But my father was also very lucky because already my grandfather produced the Barolo Chinato like many other producers here. But Zabaldano, yes, was one of the most, together with the other incredible master, Capellano.
When your dad would drink Barolo Chinato, how would he take it? Did he put a peel of citrus in it? Did he drink it on ice or leave the bottle open for a long time?
The Barolo Chinato, my father loved to have with black chocolate. Not milk, black chocolate. He always like after the dinner. Or, of course, to share with the people when they came here. But Barolo Chinato with black chocolate is unbelievable. So it was the way. Then it could also happen that during summer, but not my father, more the kids, more us, we had a little bit of water with ice and just a hint of Barolo Chinato. But it was more the kids' way of enjoying, because it was a good way to have a small amount. Because, of course, when you are 10 years old, it's not so easy to drink Barolo Chinato and have this incredible taste with just it. But my father, no, never do that. He loved to have Barolo Chinato with black chocolates.
Your dad was, I believe, a pretty popular guy locally, and many people would come to see him and to taste, and from other regions too, and writers. And I have heard, although it's before my era, because your dad died in 2012 and I never met him, but I've heard that many personalities would come to be in the tasting room. And I was just curious if you remember some of the people who came through, if they left an impression on you.
My father, first of all, had a lot of friends. He enjoyed life, but his best hobby was to play cards. So every Sunday, you will find him in Monforte in a restaurant called the Grappolo d'Oro. And he was always there playing cards. So... yes, like other producers had the possibility to meet interesting persons. But my father was very jealous about these people. And he always told us, never tell that this person has come and visit me. Because for him, it was a way to be not loyal with this person. Okay. Sometimes there were some famous actors, but what my father always told me, said, we don't have to tell that this person is here. Otherwise, we will betray his friendship, because it seems that we use that to tell the people that. So I am sorry, but I want to honor this instead of telling you that this guy came, because in my opinion, I really now... that I'm 43, I really, on that period, they said, no, Papa, why we don't say that this coming? Well, also with my friends, I'm going to... And then he told me that, and I never... But now, at 43, I really understand. And so, we don't have to betray their friendship. And I'm sure that he was right. Because if we started to say that guy is coming, that guy will stop to come. It was unbelievable how I really remember my father with those persons. And sometimes were people that if you just maybe if you have to meet them, you will have 30 people before that they will tell you, now have you a pass? No. That people together with my father, they were tasting the Barolo Chinato. My father sometimes will say, you are wrong. And then I saw the car with the bodyguards and all the other people. And to me, now this was a magic thing. And I understand what my father said, no. No, you don't, please, please, no, it was more like to say, you must not say that. So my father has passed away, and I would like to honor this this advice.
Giacomo Canterno would like to honor the legacy of his father, Aldo Canterno, in Monforte. Thank you very much for being here today.
It was my pleasure, and thank you to invite me.
Giacomo Canterno of Aldo Canterno in Monforte in Piemonte. This interview was made possible by Colazione, Italy's largest literature, music, wine, and food festival. Colazione is where great authors, wine experts, chefs, and concerts meet each year in the town of Barolo. Our new intro music was written and performed by Rob Moose and Thomas Bartlett. Go to robmoose.com, robmoose.com for more information about a very talented musician. As we finish up this episode, we have some thank yous to give. A big thank you to Erin Scala, who does the warm-up segments for this show. You can find her own blog at thinking-drinking.com. Also a thank you to Alder Yarrow and his website vinography.com, where you can find write-ups and warm-ups for the show, as well as other excellent content. And a thanks to our retail partner, Crush Wine and Spirits in Manhattan, with whom we have a wine club for regularly discounted offers on wines that we feature on this show. You can write to me directly at levyopenswine@gmail.com to find out how you can join our wine club. That's Levy with an I, openswine@gmail.com to find out about the wine club. And thanks to you for listening. Together we make wine more personal. You can let us know what you think on our Facebook page. Search for it at Drink to That Pod. You can also find us on Twitter at Drink to That Pod, or you can check out the pictures on Instagram at Levy Opens Wine. If you have an Android phone, note that we're on Google Play Music and quite happy to be there. If you have an iPhone, hit us up on iTunes. We love iTunes comments and ratings. We really do. It actually goes a long way to helping out the show, too. And if you haven't subscribed to the show yet, you should. iTunes subscribers see new episodes in their feed before non-subscribers, sometimes as much as a day or two earlier. If you want to listen to the newest episodes, and also if you want to listen to back episodes from when we first got started with episode 1, the easiest way to do so is to subscribe. Our website is alldrinktothatpod.com, alldrinktothatpod.com, I-L-L, no apostrophe, drinktothatpod.com, where you can find information about the amazing All Drink to That t-shirts, hoodies, and throw pillows. That's right, throw pillows. You can also find out how to donate to the show on alldrinktothatpod.com. Donations have made a huge, huge difference to this show in the past. If you want to make that difference in the future, and if you've enjoyed listening to some of the interviews we've released this year with the likes of John Nicola Mayo, Danny Meyer, Danielle Brunier, Ian Daggett, John Kongsgaard, Paul Greco, Jean-Louis Chave, Nicoletta Boca, and others, and I'll just take your thanks for pronouncing all those correctly because it's been a challenge over the year, please consider donating. Cheers.